Broadcasting from the gulag city of planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer, and in a little bit we'll bring in our guest for the evening. But first, I want to talk about, in connection with the forthcoming Breaking the Chains conference scheduled for Houston this April 1st through 3rd, we're bringing in a series of guests and panelists to talk about the racial bias that threatens to destroy the United States if we cannot restore liberty to its proper place. And here to give you his interpretation of that situation is the head of the Drug Policy Alliance.
The executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman.
Racism played a major role in the onset of drug prohibition. The first anti-opium laws in this country were in Nevada and California and were very clearly directed at Chinese minorities and Chinese immigrants. The first anti-cocaine laws were directed at blacks in the South. The first anti-marijuana laws at Mexicans and Mexican-Americans in the Southwest in the teens and the 20s. So we see this kind of racist strain of the drug war really right from the beginning up to the current day when we have this grossly disproportionate impact of the drug war on Latino and black communities in this country. But the other thing I can say is, Drug Policy Alliance may be the leading organization in the country, if not the world, promoting alternatives to the war on drugs. But our ability to be effective really depends upon how many people are with us. You know, we have about 10,000 members who contribute a little bit of money. We have about 50,000 who are on our email list. If you do believe and do care about ending the war on drugs, just please do go to the website. It's drugpolicy.org.
I am very proud to welcome our guest for the evening. He is the senior servant and founder of the Metropolitan Interdenominational Church out of Nashville, Tennessee, the Reverend Edwin C. Sanders II. Good evening, Reverend.
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm well, sir. I'm so proud to have you with us. If you would, please tell my listeners a bit about yourself and the work you do.
Okay, well, I'm the senior servant at Metropolitan Interdenominational Church in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a 23-year-old congregation, a congregation that has, throughout its existence, been clearly defined as a congregation that's inclusive, reconciling, and engaged in trying to address social justice issues in a way that allows us to be able to find avenues to bring our entire community into being involved in responding to the kinds of things that have continually translated into the oppressive and world in which many of us find ourselves living. We are a congregation that has made a commitment over the years to minister to persons who in one way or another have been impacted by the ways in which substance abuse and use might have affected their lives. But one of the things that we've become very concerned about in recent years is the way in which there is, this clear injustice that's being perpetrated in the way in which persons are being dealt with around, prosecution and conviction as relates to drug laws in this country.
Yes, sir. You look at the stats, and they say that whites and blacks, proportionately use drugs about the same. But when you look at those that are arrested, and then those that are tried, and then those convicted, and finally sent to prison, it winds up that blacks go to prison at a rate 5, 6, 8 times as often as whites do.
Right. As a matter of fact, it's very, like you said, it's very clear when you look at the statistics that when it translates into who goes to prison and who it is that ends up really fueling this, the prison industrial complex, this whole business of making money, off of incarcerating folks is something that has to be addressed in a forthright manner.
Yes, sir. I've had representatives from the NAACP and many others, people, voices of reason, if you will, that have pointed out this inequity, this disparity. And it is necessary to awaken folks to this need for change and to get on board in helping to make that change. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. But one of the things that we know, especially when you talk about any situation where you're having a disproportionate impact within the African-American community, we know historically how important it is to bring the voice of the faith community into the equation. It's important for us to continue to develop a level of consciousness amongst faith leaders that allow us to lend our energy to trying to influence the ways in which policy is being set and laws are being, you know, enacted that are, you know, continuing to perpetuate this madness. So one of the things that we have done through Religious Leaders for a More Just and Compassionate Drug Policy is that we have worked hard at creating forums around the country that serve to, you know, provide insight and provide information to clergy so that they will be able to identify ways in which they can buy in and become a part of the struggle. And it is essential that we have their voices, because it's clear that if you're going to, you know, have the kind of change that we're looking to see, you have to have the church involved.
Yes, sir. I wholeheartedly agree. Now, I look at your resume, if you will, here. What is something I got off the internet, and it talks about that you your congregation helps to fight substance abuse, but you also provide advocacy for children. You fight against sexual violence within the community and just harm reduction overall. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, no, I think that what you find is that on, you know, a given day, there might be a way in which we are emphasizing one of the issues that clearly is a part of, you know, the fabric of, you know, discrimination and injustice within our communities. But I think that on any given day, you might focus on one thing. But the fact is, all those things are related. When you consider what's going on in terms of all the issues of health disparity, when you look at what's going on in terms of patterns related to substance abuse and incarceration, when you look at the things that are going on in, you know, in our education system and the like, there are certain variables that seemingly end up being consistent and the same in every instance. In every instance, it ends up being people who are left out of the equation in terms of economic opportunity. It's people who do not have access to quality education. It's people who find themselves in one way or another not being able to realize their full potential because of stumbling blocks that they have to encounter every day, which compromise them and their ability to achieve that which, you know, might, you know, be that which we want to, which they desire in terms of a quality of life that is equal to and on par with any. So I guess what I'm saying is you will see that we deal with sexual violence, we deal with advocacy for children, we deal with substance abuse, we deal, you know, with HIV/AIDS, we deal with the issue of health disparity across the board. But the fact is, if you look at where, you know, there is a common thread in all of those issues over and over again, it turns out that it has to be, you know, it turns out to be socioeconomic.
Yes, sir. If you would, tell us a bit about the First Response Center.
The First Response Center is a very comprehensive umbrella organization. It's a vehicle by which we do major ministry within our congregation. We are a congregation that has been involved in what has translated into being called in recent times the Faith Initiative. What ends up being the practical byproduct of the Faith Initiative is something that we've been doing for years at the First Response Center, because we have been trying to use all of the vehicles available to us to try to make sure that we respond to the tough issues in our communities and try to improve the quality of life for all folks. So it ends up being the way in which we do social outreach. It's the vehicle by which we do social outreach.
Very good. Yes, sir. Many of the major cities of America are still without a needle a needle exchange program. And how is Nashville in that regard, sir?
One of the things that we just simply say is that we try to make sure that everything we do is science-based and driven by facts in terms of what we know have direct positive impact upon, you know, ending the way in which the effect of substance abuse is, you know, is devastating our communities. One of the things that we know from the research that's been done, there are studies that have been done at CDC, there are studies that have been done through other, you know, agencies around the country and the world that seem to indicate that you would, you know, you are able to drive numbers down when folks who are injection users have, you know, clean syringes. But one of the things that we know is that very often there's a lot of hysteria, There's a very often an emotional response that comes when you talk about this because folks don't understand it in terms of the science. So one of the things that we try to do is make sure that people understand the science. I think that everything we do in this age has to be science-based. It has to be, you know, something that we can demonstrate in clear, you know, terms as having the effect that we're trying to have upon, you know, trying to end the ways in which, especially with you know, the syringe exchange issue, the way in which it impacts the spread of HIV and AIDS. So I think, like in most countries, most cities around the country, what we're seeing is more and more people who are right-minded and people who are objective and reasonable and people who are looking at the facts, understanding that this ends up being another piece of the equation that you have to include if you're going to be effective in responding to the crisis of HIV/AIDS in our community. What we see in our community is that the incidence of infection is still very much tied to injection drug use. So if we know that that's one of the strategies that's effective, then we have to be open in a way in which we employ every strategy that helps us to stop this pandemic from the devastating impact it's having upon us.
Yes, sir. Now, insofar as, you know, I would say the majority of the churches in America, they have compassion, they work for their communities, they do things to support those in need. But I think the one area where many of them, and again, I'm not wanting to point fingers, but where many of them come up short is in working towards harm reduction, that the obvious benefits of needle exchange and or other mechanisms that could stop some of these harms of the drug war. Go ahead, sir.
Let me tell you how we deal with that. Our position is that all of the protocols, all of the strategies that we develop as we initiate our various programs, in every instance, we always say that the ideal is that there would be behavior modification that would translate into people abstaining from self-destructive behavior. The fact, though, is that we know that even though we have that as an ideal in terms of, you know, folks not engaging in self-destructive behavior, when we do find that behavior, one of the things that we have to do is try to address the problem in a way that makes sure that we minimize the harm that's being done while we're able to move people forward as far as making the kinds of decisions that would allow them to not compromise their own lives and the lives of people who they love and care about. So, I'm just being, you know, straight with you. We always start off by saying, you know, don't. But if you do, then there are things, obviously, that you should do that have a tremendous impact upon, you know, you're lessening the likelihood that the impact is any more devastating than it has to be.
Yes, sir. Well, very true. We're going to take just a short little break, less than a minute, and we'll be right back, Reverend.
All right.
Thank you.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
In his State of the Union speech, here's what George Bush should say about his new Medicare bill.
My fellow Americans, my Medicare bill has real drug benefits, but not for you, for my contributors at the big drug companies. My bill actually forbids Medicare from negotiating lower drug prices, so you'll probably have to pay more for your prescriptions than you do now. And you won't be able to get cheaper prescriptions from Canada.
The Bush Medicare sellout. It's enough to make you sick.
Message produced by MoveOn.org.
Yes, Reverend Sanders, I don't know how these prescription plans and lack of insurance and health care is impacting your congregation, but could you give us a snapshot of what you're able to perceive?
Well, you know, one of the things I think you have to appreciate is that, you know, we have seen consistently a pattern where we have not gotten, I think, where we want to be in terms of the availability of quality health care to all the citizens of this country. As a matter of fact, it's very clear to me that we need to be on par with other progressive, advanced nations in the world in terms of being able to provide health care to all of our citizens. I think we ought to be able to do that the same way it's done fairly effectively in Canada. Clearly, it's done in other parts of Europe and Scandinavia. I think that we have the resource and the capacity to do it. I think that what we're trying to do is develop the will amongst all the parties that are necessary to bring to the table and persuade, you know, to be a part of making this change. But when you talk about, you know, where this, you know, is lodged in terms of who is responsible, the fact is we haven't gotten the response we needed from, you know, Democrats or from Republicans. If we had, we just got through with an era where there was, you know, Democratic leadership for 8 years. We didn't get it from Bill Clinton. We haven't gotten it from George Bush. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is to work with, you know, the persons that are part of the current, you know, administration to see to it if we can't move this issue forward. Because I believe that it really is going to be it's going to be a problem that will be solved when the will of the people is such that there's the groundswell of support. And the issue gets so often framed in terms of partisan politics and personalities that people get lost in terms of what the realities are. So we have to speak to the realities of the people whose lives are being affected, how their lives are being affected, the negative impact that's being had. We've got to make sure that the voices are being heard of people who are suffering because they don't have the access that they need to drugs and to health care in the way in which it's, you know, really should be given in this country. So one of the things that I'm always trying to do is create vehicles by which those voices can be heard. And because I think if those voices are heard, one thing I know about politicians is they understand that it's people who go out and vote who allow them to be able to continue to serve. And if you get the groundswell of response from within the masses of folks in this country and the electorate ends up, you know, saying this is what we want to see, then I'm convinced we'll get it because folks do want to continue to be elected.
Yes, sir. Again, looking at your resume, I see where you've worked and studied at Yale University Divinity School. You're involved in associated with the NAACP, a member of the Alcohol and Drug Council of Middle Tennessee, a member of the Drug Policy Alliance, coordinator for religious leaders for a more just and compassionate drug policy, and you're now serving on the President's Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS. I think, you know, a gentleman of your stature, your caliber, speaks with such great dignity. Why can we not bend the ears of some of these politicians more? Because, in my opinion, the majority of people, at least in regards to marijuana or needle exchange, are there. What's it going to take to maneuver them that last step?
Well, I think you have to be real, you know, you have to be real clear about the fact is that, you know, when you say they're there, the fact is when you look at a lot of the polls that are done and the fact, I'm not sure they are there because there's still a lot of hysteria around these issues. There's not factual substantive information that's driving the response that we see very often. I guarantee you, if you go around Houston and talk to most folks, especially within the faith community, there's clearly not a support for changes in laws, especially, you know, as relates to marijuana, and there definitely is not the support for the change in terms of even the strategy, you know, towards harm reduction. That's what I mean when I tell you a lot of education has to be done. And I think what we have to do is we have to invest money in terms of making sure that, you know, that the treatment opportunities are available for folks, that we get away from this punitive approach to dealing with substance abuse to one that has to do, you know, instead of with, you know, incarceration, we really ought to be talking about, you know, the opportunities for transformation through treatment, you know, and therapy. There's a way in which the whole dynamic of criminalization does nothing to solve the problem. And we have to be about trying to help folks to understand in terms of the facts, in terms of the statistics, in terms of what we can prove scientifically, that a lot more can be gained in terms of dealing with the problem that we see around substance abuse if indeed we change our strategy and invest our money in ways that are not driven by, you know, criminalization, but rather dealing with treatment and rehabilitation.
Yes, sir. I went to on the website today. I looked on the Nashville, Tennessean website, and I saw a story that's just, I'm sure it's just representative, happens every day in every city in America. And I'll read it briefly. Metro Police said an incident involving illegal drugs probably sparked a shooting, this would be Monday morning, in North Nashville, where a woman is believed to have shot another woman and left her in critical condition. Police were called, and there were reports of gunshots, said Detective Roy Dunaway. This...
Yeah, actually, I'm very close to that story.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Actually, no. Two of the folks are involved, the three names are included. The gentleman that was arrested, as well as the woman who was, I guess, supposedly identified as the person who actually shot the other individual. But let me just tell you.
Yes, sir.
That story is repeated in our cities across this country every day. And we know that it's repeated in our cities across this country every day because of the way in which we are dealing with responding to this issue of drugs in our communities. But the fact is, if you come into most communities and raise the question with folks in terms of, you know, what needs to be done, there's still very often the mindset that says, you know, we've got to incarcerate people, we've got to lock folks up and get them off the street, over against understanding how really we have to develop strategies that will end this, you know, this scourge in our community in a way that really makes the difference that we're looking for. That's what I mean when I say there's a lot of education that has to be done in the community. That's why you have to bring the church into the equation. That's where, you know, you have to have people who have congregations that they speak to every day, which ends up being the vehicle by which folks become informed, you know the truth, and are able then to respond, you know, to the issues in a more well-informed and intelligent manner. Right now, it's all driven very often by hysteria and misinformation. And one of the things we try hard to do is make sure that there is, you know, honest and correct information, and that, you know, the emotional knee-jerk response that somehow suggests if you just lock enough folks up, the problem's going to go away, will be understood to be senseless and something that we cannot continue.
Yes, sir. Now, we have, you know, as I mentioned early on, a Breaking the Chains conference headed for Houston on April 1st through 3rd.
Right.
That's being sponsored by the Drug Policy Alliance. And I was wondering if you'd tell the folks a little bit about your association with the DPA.
Yes, I will be there. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I am involved with the DPA is that, see, I like I was telling you earlier, I appreciate the fact of the way in which this issue of drug policy and substance abuse is disproportionately impacting our communities. But I understand that unless you have the faith community involved in developing the response, you're not going to be effective. I tell you, the folks who have, you know, done the research, the people who do, you know, the analysis, the people who have developed, I think, the science around this problem, are people who are very intelligent, but they're not very often people who have rapport, credibility, or the ability to be able to communicate that which they are trying to, you know, achieve with folks in our communities. So that's the reason why I feel that it's important for the faith community to be involved. I mean, I'm about dealing with truth. I'm about dealing with helping and healing people. I'm about restoration. I'm about the business of trying to help people develop their full potential. You know, I'm not bogged down on, you know, on public policy issues. I'm not dealing with abstract theoretical stuff. I'm talking about people in their lives. I serve people every day, like this story that you just read, you know, whose lives are being compromised, whose lives are being lost, and I'm not going to allow myself to get caught up in, you know, in the debate in a way that does not translate into change. So what I'm about is trying to mobilize within the faith community voices that bring, you know, truth to bear in terms of how the issues have to be addressed, and then, again, develop the response within the community that puts us on the right track. So the reason why I'm involved is I'm convinced the voice of the faith community has to be at the table. It has to be at the table. That's one reason why I'm excited to be, you know, an appointee to the president's, you know, council on HIV and AIDS. It's the reason why I want to be at the table, where people very often think you won't show up at the table. I try to be at the table of people who, you know, I mean, people just write off folks and say, well, they're conservative or they're this, that, and the other. The fact is, if you're not at the table to influence how people are thinking, I doubt very seriously you're going to get the change you're looking for. Now, that's just one part of the strategy. I mean, obviously, you have to have advocacy. You have to have aggressive activity from other directions. But I know that you have to have folks who are willing to sit at the table, debate the issues, and advance the cause in a way that it brings about the change we're looking for.
Yes, indeed, the very changes that we are looking for in drug reform. And I want to thank the Reverend Edwin C. Sanders II, the senior servant of the Metropolitan Interdenominational Church of Nashville, Tennessee, for being our guest on Cultural Baggage. It is with great sadness that we announce this week's Drug Reform Hero of the Week. I sat with him in San Francisco numerous times and shared a few bowls and talked about liberty and the possibility of a better America. We're speaking of a gentleman who headed up the political arm of the U.S. Libertarian Party. We announce today the passing of a great American, Ron Krickenberger. This week's Cultural Baggage, Drug Reform Hero of the Week.
Mr. K, tell us what happened today.
Okay, basically I went to court this morning, went for a hearing on a revoked on my deferred adjudication. I went before the judge. My court-appointed attorney came in and told me that the DA was still standing by her four-year TDC sentencing on my reprimands and everything from last month, the way she had it written. They changed one line on the form to where I left it without an agreement, so that way I could let the judge make the decision, and I left it up to him. It wasn't up to me, and it wasn't up to the district attorney. The judge abandoned the dirty UA for coke. He abandoned the supposedly admission of that I admitted to my probation officer on August 22nd that I'd smoked marijuana, which I denied, and one other reprimand against me. And I had three UAs that showed tetrahydrocannabinols, which is THC. In them, that's what I was sentenced for. I was sentenced to 3 years TDC.
So I don't know how much longer our reporter will be able to tell us about the inside of the Harris County Jail. However, we should all keep in mind that he's being sent to prison for possession in his bloodstream of less than 1/1,000,000th of a gram of marijuana by a crime lab that has now been thoroughly discredited. In any case, I want to say thank you for your courage, Mr. K. It's my hope that you'll join us here next time on Cultural Baggage, when our guest will be Steve Bloom, the chief editor of High Times Magazine, and we'll be talking about the forthcoming split between the Grower's Guide and the Entrepreneur's Magazine. That's next week on Cultural Baggage. In closing, as always, I must remind you that because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. So please, be careful. For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.